And that we will be streaming it to our Facebook page as well. And so that is also starting. And now you can take over, Harold.
Okay. Well, welcome to National Capital Astronomers. So this meeting is being live streamed. Got it. Okay. Okay. Stay muted unless you need to. I will mute myself. Our speaker will tell us whether she wants to be talked about in the meeting or not. And, you know, whatever the... Okay. Now, for the good of the order, Jack Gaffey, tell us about the Mid-Atlantic Planetarium Society meeting coming up.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Actually, I have two announcements. Okay. This month, the APS seniors meeting will be on the third Wednesday, April 19, rather than the usual third Wednesday. The talk will be titled "The Murrow Boys, Radio News Broadcasting During World War II. CBS hired Edward R. Murrow to arrange for broadcasts from Europe, and Murrow hired some young journalists, including Eric Severide, Charles Collingwood, and Larry LeSueur, who reported via shortwave radio from London, Paris, Rome, and other cities in Europe. But my second announcement, change hats, is I'm chairman of the NCA nominating committee along with Jeff Norman and Wayne Warren. And we announced that, no, there will be an election in June. All the offices are open. We welcome candidates. So, Please contact me. My email address is in Stardust if you are interested in running. In the May Stardust, we will announce the candidates for the office. And in the June meeting, we will elect them.
And in the June meeting, when we elect them, you can actually nominate yourself and change it. But
yeah,
it's already been decided that the president, that's me, will be replaced because there have already been people that have agreed to take over from me, because I don't want to be president for life. And, you know, we are a democracy and we believe in democratic principles.
Don't we have term limits anyway?
Yeah. Right. Now, yeah, we're supposed to, and I'm trying to enforce them as best as possible. And let me see. The other thing is, David Dunham, do you have anything to say about occultations upcoming? Other than, of course, what's published in Stardust.
Yeah, there's not too much to say other than what's in Stardust as far as the future. Just this past week, the moon was passing through the Milky Way, and there were a lot of good occultations, and some people in England told about all these fantastic observations that they made during the moon passing through the rich Milky Way star fields in Gemini, but they've all been clouded out here, so we haven't been able to participate in that. But we did, have a very interesting recent success with a large collaborative effort with about 40 observers who spread out along a path from Kansas to North Carolina to observe an occultation by the Trojan asteroid Polymele that occurred on March 26th, the Saturday evening, the 27th Universal Time. And so there's some interesting things that will be mentioned in a press release that the Southwest Research Institute is getting together about that unusual shape and so forth, but we'll wait until they send that out, and we can probably give a link to that in the next Stardust. I haven't had time. I wanted to write up in January. We had a very interesting occultation where we observed an occultation of what turned out to be a close double star. We went back in the records and found out that the star duplicity had been discovered during a lunar occultation back in 1974 or so, a photoelectric record made in at McDonald Observatory by David Evans. And at the time, the photoelectric recording was noisy, and we said, well, maybe this is a double, but we're not sure. So while we confirmed it in spades with our observations, we set up three stations ourselves, and there were three other mobile observers who observed it all around the Tucson area and northward. And so all of us had just a single occultation of the star, except for Paul Maley, who went right to the center line, the predicted center line, which he often does. And he had occultations of both components. So for a short time, he had a complete occultation of the star, where the rest of us had one of the components visible the whole time, so that we had to analyze our light curves properly and everything. And so we've got a solution, and I plan to write an article about it, hopefully for the next Stardust.
Excellent. Are you physically in Arizona or Maryland right now, David?
Now, we're in Maryland right now. We're on Tuesday. We're going back to Arizona for about a month and a half, and then we'll come back here for the rest of the summer.
Okay. Now, is there anybody else that needs to make an announcement for the good for the order?
Sue raised her hand for NJ.
Okay. Okay. Jay first, because I saw his hand first, and then Sue.
All right. Exploring the sky still is on hold. I and also Guy Brandenburg have tried to contact the people at the Rock Creek Park Nature Center with no success. So nobody is answering the phone there.
Have they fixed their planetarium?
Beg pardon?
Is their planetarium still busted, as far as you know?
Oh, I have no idea. The whole center is closed.
Okay,
it's not open.
Okay.
I and also David had attended this two-day conference on the two upcoming solar eclipses. And I spoke to Don, last name, I'll get the last name. But anyway, he runs this program on the mall.
Oh, yes.
My pardon?
Now I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he runs the program on the mall that'll be June 25th, I think it is. Between 4th and 7th, and I'll bring a telescope there. The folk festival is also going on, so we probably have a lot of people there. In the skies.
He also did something last week with the Eisenhower thing.
Yeah.
Did you go to that?
No, I did not go to that.
I didn't either because the weather was bad. Hey, your cat's
I did go to it. And it was successful. One of the organizers from the Trust for the Mall estimated about 200 people came.
His dog got sick.
That there were increasing clouds through the evening. Just about the only thing in the sky that any of the telescopes could be trained on was Sirius. We did see the space station fly over there. I put my telescope on and some of the windows in the Capitol Dome. Which we could see from there, though through the trees. There were about three of us from the Goddard Astronomy Club. There were people from NOVAC. I don't remember if anybody else from NCA was there. There were a couple other groups. Of course, Don's people from Hofstra University, although Don himself fell ill that day and could not make it. There were several people from the Trust for the National Mall.
And that was the original people that organized the whole thing.
Yes.
I was originally supposed to go too, but that day I took delivery of a new donated telescope, and that in accidents knocked me out from being able to go. Plus the weather wasn't, had the weather been clear, I would have gone anyway, but since the weather was so iffy, I figured there was less opportunity.
Yeah, there's also supposed to be the Rockville Science Center is supposed to have a science program at Montgomery College in Rockville in a couple of weeks. But I personally am not ready to do anything with the public, so I didn't do anything.
I will show sunspots or shock people with Vandegraaff generators, depending upon the weather, which is what I do at Rockville Science Day, since that's one of the other campuses at Montgomery College. Now, Sue still wanted to mention something.
Harold?
Yes?
For Rockville Science Day, if you're showing the Vandegraaff generator, you should come over and join us at Gravity is Optional.
Oh, I know. And I know the person that operates that is actually a high school colleague of mine.
Robert Clemenzi?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
In fact, I shocked him with a Vandegraaff generator and got in trouble when I was in high school, and I almost got disciplined, not quite, by the physics teacher. So, but he's forgiven me for my cruelty. He's a very forgiving person.
Yes.
Now, Sue wants to speak too, right? Before I turn.
Okay. The Astronomical Society of Greenbelt will meet on Thursday, April 28th. One of our members will discuss his experiences in building an amateur radio telescope. And I will send out a notice to the groups.io because we are attempting to transition possibly back to in-person meetings or hybrid meetings. The venue we use is starting to open up again, so we're not quite sure what kind of a meeting it's going to be, but I will update you folks. That's all I have to say.
One other point from me. Some of you may have heard of a French company called Unistellar that is selling telescopes now that image stack. When I first heard about that, it sounded like bullshit to me. I now know it's not bullshit. Monday, I actually saw the Montgomery College at Rockville has a Unistellar Equinox. Carrie Fitzgerald, the Rockville astronomy person, has done wonderful things with it. I want to get one for the new planetarium within a year or two, you know, so we can do outreach and stuff with that. If you're thinking about buying a telescope right now, I would recommend that you look, of course, all these things are expensive. I would suggest that you look into Unistellar very seriously. They also have a new two one that's just coming out. They're actually computers and they have image stacking. And I think they probably use Stellarium, which have also is French, as their database. So they have every star in the sky and more that's known to man, and a wonderful catalog. So,
yeah, I've got a lot of telescopes, but I was looking yesterday at their website, and the Unistellar 2 looks very, very interesting.
I mean,
you know, for outreach.
I salivate with that when I saw
yes.
I saw that. I plan to get my employer to buy me one as well.
Buy
as
it too.
I already have, I know, I've already installed the thing on my phone so I can use Carrie's at Rockville.
There's a couple other people who have their hands raised. David has a question. I have a question. Then Jeff Gerber has a question.
Okay. Yes. Okay, Jeff.
David.
Yes.
This is Joan. I wanted to say that yesterday I went to the I listened in on the Skywatchathon or whatever they wanted to call it. It was basically almost entirely about astrophotography. It was interesting, but of course, I'm not an astrophotographer, so a lot of it was way over my head. but it was very interesting, and it's completely recorded, and they have a series of YouTube events that occur weekly. You can find them on skywatcherusa.com. Yesterday's was an all-day one. Most of them are usually about an hour. Yesterday's was to replace Neve. So they were talking about new products, although not as much as I would have liked to see. But it was very interesting.
Thank you, Janet.
Yeah, well, I also wanted to add, there was an online Neve this morning, and they have three recorded lectures is all they've got. And if you go to the Neve website, you can see those. There's one by Alan Stern, which gave an update on the New Horizons and Pluto. And he's coming out with a new book, which gives the latest revelations about Pluto. So that'll be interesting.
Please inform us of all these things on the listserv, the one with IO that goes to most of us NCA members.
He chose not to inform anybody.
I got an email message in the morning, and when I got up, I saw it.
Well, all these other things that you're talking about that we can still tie on to.
Right.
Because we all do a certain amount of education. Few of us even get paid for it. Now, do you have something, Jeff?
Yes. I just wanted to add about the event on the mall last weekend, and the Eisenhower Memorial turned out to be quite a good venue for that event. It's a fairly large open plaza with benches and low walls that you can then put your gear on or that people can sit on. And there's a pretty good view, of the sky from there. Of course, it's right downtown, so there are lots of lights everywhere, but for where it is, it's a pretty good venue.
And a unistellar in that position would have allowed you to be able to see galaxies. I can tell you that because Carrie saw the Orion Nebula much better than I can ever see it in a much darker area around here. So, okay. You can lower your hand when you're finished.
Clouds coming in?
And unfortunately, clouds came in. Elizabeth, do you want to say something?
Yes. So we've actually, the University of Maryland will be holding its annual Maryland Day, which is the campus-wide open house. It's coming up on April 30th, the last Saturday of the month. It'll be pretty much just like it was before the pandemic. At least that's how they're planning it right now. So we'll be set up in the tents out in front of Martin Engineering building. We'll have a solar telescope set up there as well. The other thing is that we've got the inaugural Ahern lecture coming up on April 20th on campus. It'll be held at the Edward St. John Building, ESJ, at 5:00 on April 20th. There will be a small reception beforehand and generally following protocols, otherwise wearing masks indoors because we're still on campus and such. But that's coming up. I don't know if they're going to be videoing it or live streaming it anyway. If I find out anything, I'll let you know.
Please do. Okay. Is there anything else that anybody needs to say before I introduce our vice president and mute myself, who will introduce our real speaker? Okay, take it away.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Johanna Teske, our speaker this evening. She obtained a Bachelor of Science in Physics from American University, and while still an undergraduate, she was already giving talks on her research on merging galaxies. She then obtained a PhD in astronomy from the University of Arizona, and then a prestigious Origins postdoctoral fellowship at the Carnegie Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. She continued her Origins Fellowship at the Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, California. And while there in 2017, she was awarded the very prestigious NASA Hubble Postdoctoral Fellowship. She's now a staff scientist at the Carnegie Earth and Planets Lab, which used to be called the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. Her research focuses on finding and characterizing planets around other stars. And to do that, she works on precision measurements of the velocities of stars and their planets, on the atmospheres and interiors of exoplanets, the effects of activities such as flares and coronal mass ejections of a host star upon its planets, how the composition of a star affects the formation of its planets, the search for Earth-like exoplanets, and planets in systems consisting not just of one star, but of two or three stars. And she also works on the evolution of galaxies. She's heavily involved in large databases widely used by astronomers, the Magellan Test Survey, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the Apogee Survey, and the important Vizier online catalog of astronomical objects. She recently gave a talk on her work to a group of astronomers at the University of Maryland, and it was really quite striking. It really beautifully exemplified how science works at its best, how relentlessly challenging your own results and cross-checking and all that difficult work, which requires great ingenuity, leads to results that are so reliable that they can usefully be built upon by yourself and by others. That's really what distinguishes science from most other human endeavors. And it's also why science progresses so rapidly. In addition to making measurements with sophisticated astronomical instruments, she also works on developing and upgrading those instruments. And besides very extensive teaching, she has mentored many undergraduate and graduate students. She has also worked to make the scientific community more inclusive and diverse. Dr. Teske.
Wow, thank you for that introduction. I really appreciate it. All right, and thanks for the invitation. I'm excited to talk to you tonight. All right, so I'll do share screen first. And you'll see, this screen. See a nice starry background. And then if I hit play, you should see my first slide.
Yes, we do.
Okay, great. Let me minimize. I'm going to minimize my Zoom window so I won't see you. But so please just speak up if you have a question. That's fine to interrupt me during the talk. And then we can also, have questions at the end. All right. So tonight I'm going to talk to you about a little bit about my research, but also just sort of a broader review of the connection between exoplanets, planets around other stars, and their host stars, and how they're related compositionally. I should say, this is definitely a limited and biased review. There's a lot that I couldn't fit into the talk that I'll briefly touch on at the end. But just know there's much more out there. I just sort of pick and choose selectively. You might recognize the background picture here. This is a high resolution solar spectrum from Kitt Peak. So hopefully throughout my talk, it'll be clear why I'm showing this at the start of the talk. And it, as you might suspect, is sort of false color image to show how the color corresponds to the wavelength, but I really like this image. Okay, so first, just to set the stage, I wanted to show a few different kind of maps or demographic diagrams of exoplanets. So these show the planet minimum mass or actually measured mass versus orbital period and the radius versus orbital period. And these in the background, you can see all the detected planets as of 2018. I'll come back to the latest update where we have surpassed 5,000 exoplanets. But I just wanted to show sort of the different groupings of planets that we've detected, and just point out how there's now this large and very diverse sample of planets that we found that are just very different than what's in our solar system. You can see sort of in the background, Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune and Uranus marked on the left plot. And then the smaller planets at the bottom. In the right plot, Neptune, Uranus are actually farther off to the right. In particular, my research focuses a lot on these mini Neptunes and super Earths. And so they fit into this space between rocky and ice giant worlds, really unlike anything that we've detected in our solar system. There's lots of, we don't have hot Jupiters either, but mini Neptunes and super Earths are the most common type of planet detected, at least within 100-day orbital periods around solar type stars in our galaxy. And so, it's very mysterious and interesting to me why they're so common around other stars, but we don't have one that we know of in our solar system. But anyway, this is just pointing out maybe some terms that I might use. I'll talk about kind of large, close and giant planets, hot Jupiters and mini Neptunes and super Earths. So I just wanted to point out what I meant by those. Oops, I have to click this way. So when I was thinking about this talk, I kind of came with two broad categories of ways to think about this star planet connection. So the first one is, how does the composition of the host star tell us about the presence of certain types of planets? And then the second question is, how does the host star composition help us interpret models of the planet composition, or even, formation? So I'll walk through some examples from each of these categories and some takeaways from each one. So first, we'll focus on this one. You may be familiar with kind of the best known and most robust star-planet connection that we know of so far. And that is this relationship between the metallicity in the star. And we usually parameterize that by the iron abundance in this that we measure in the star relative to hydrogen. Iron is just happens to be an easy element to measure. It is sort of representative of all the metals, not hydrogen, helium in the star. And the bracket notation you see, that just means it's relative to solar. So in this plot, I'm showing the sun would be at zero in that plot. And in this plot, there's different colored and kind of shape histograms. And this is from a while ago now, there were actually hints of this result in the first exoplanet detections, kind of the first dozen that were detected via the radial velocity method. So the Doppler wobble, where you're looking at measuring the motion of the star due to the red and blue shifting of the lines that is being caused by an orbiting planet. So even in those first detections of very large planets, there was people noticing that they seem to be around stars with larger iron abundances or metallicities. And that has continued. And so in this histogram, you see that the stars without planets, which I have in quotes because there's lots of detection biases that go into exoplanets. And so it's very hard to say for sure that a star doesn't have a planet. At all. You can put limits on what isn't there based on what data we have. Anyway, stars without planets sort of have this broad histogram. And then the giant planet host stars are in that red dashed histogram. And you can see they're skewed more to the right or to larger metallicities. This correlation supports the core accretion picture of planet formation, whereby in high metallicity environments, the cores of giant planets can grow rapidly to reach approximately 10 times the mass of Earth and continue to accrete gas in that protoplanetary disk of gas and dust. And that allows them to grow into gas giants. And planets forming in lower metallicity environments. And so here we're sort of assuming that the stellar metallicity is a proxy for the protoplanetary disk metallicity or solid content. So in those lower metallicity environments, planets might not reach large enough masses before the gas dissipates. And so they wouldn't grow into gas giants. Now this result that I was just talking about, like I said, is quite robust for the close-in gas giant planets. But you might ask, or even from that diagram, looking at the blue histogram, that the metallicity of the stars that have these smaller super Earth and Neptune mass planets don't seem to be as skewed towards higher metallicities. And this has really panned out with more detections of smaller planets via the transiting technique. We're still detecting small planets via RV, but the transit method has just really accelerated the detection the detection of exoplanets by a lot. And I'll talk more about that. And with this method, you're not measuring the mass of the planet, you're measuring the radius. And so it does appear that with smaller planets, there is a lesser dependence on the metallicity of the host star, such that their occurrence doesn't depend as much on that. And that fits into our picture of core accretion. There have been several studies that have suggested, well, this correlation just totally goes away when you go to small planets. And other studies have suggested, no, there's still some correlation. You know, they still would slightly prefer higher metallicity environments. So this is a little bit of an open question still. But it's also important to actually consider that this might not be just a one-dimensional relationship, but there could be other dimensions that matter, such as, in this case, the orbital period. And so this is a plot from this Pettigura et al. Paper from 2018, where he was looking at a sample of planets, transiting planets detected by the Kepler Space Telescope, and divided them into different sizes. So that's the colors of the lines in that bottom plot. And then also into these two bins of short period and longer period. And so you can see that in the very shortest period systems, very close in planets, they all, you know, their occurrence rates, that's what's plot on the y-axis, they all go up with metallicity, although at different rates. But what I think is interesting, and that I'll dig into a little bit next, is that at longer periods, especially those super Earth and sub Neptune planets, flatten out this relationship with the occurrence rate and metallicity, and they might even be different. So even though these two sizes of the planets, you know, they're somewhat similar. Usually we think of super Earths as something like 1 to 1.5 Earth radii. And then the sub Neptunes or the mini Neptunes are like 2 to 3 Earth radii. Anyway, they might have different relationships with metallicity, even though they're not so different in size. Zooming out kind of more on this picture with some even more recent results, I want to walk you through a study of that sample of planets detected by Kepler, so transiting planets. And this is a paper by Owen and Murray Clay in 2018, but has been, my picture of it has been influenced by several other papers that I have there in the lower left. And so this work focuses again on that host star bulk metallicity, which they're calling, or I'm calling in this plot Z, That's what another like abbreviation people use for metals and star. And so I'm going to talk about it now, the metallicity, the Z and periods of planets. In particular, I'm interested in those smaller planets. So that's what I'm talking about here. So these authors found that the sub-Neptune planets, so the slightly larger ones, are more common around the higher metallicity stars and also larger around higher metallicity stars. And again, these are planets that were probably born with some sort of hydrogen helium envelope and have retained it. And that's why they're bigger. That's why their radii are, we observe them to be larger. And that could be perhaps at these longer periods because they didn't suffer high radiation from the star early in the star's lifetime that would have evaporated their atmospheres. And so the idea here is that these planets around the higher metallicity stars could grow more massive and thus accrete larger envelopes. And the authors here also found that the super Earths with those longer periods are more common around lower metallicity stars, which you can sort of see in this plot here. The super Earth trend with metallicity at the longer periods is kind of flat or maybe has the opposite slope as the sub-Neptunes. So this was a doing lots of animations. So this was an independent study, but sort of a similar finding. And in particular, at the longer orbital periods, this can't be an effect of, or likely isn't an effect of the planets losing their atmospheres, right? Starting out big and getting the atmosphere blown off by the star because they're far enough away that that probably wasn't such an impacting factor. And so the idea here is that when more solids are present, it's easier to produce those cores, right? The planet cores that can hold on to the hydrogen helium envelope before the gas is dispersed. So similar to the giant planets just scaled down. And so these small planets at longer periods are likely to be the ones where, and the low metallicity, where the solids couldn't produce a core that was massive enough. It didn't cross some threshold to be able to acquire an envelope with a large enough mass fraction before the gas disk dispersed during that period of planet formation. Now, looking at those shorter orbital periods, in this case, the super Earths probably do represent solid cores alone, independent of how much hydrogen helium they would have initially accreted. And the solid cores that form around lower metallicity stars typically have, are typically smaller and so probably are less massive. That fits into this picture. Interestingly, the authors also generally find that the average host star metallicity of these sub-Neptunes increases inside of about 20 days. And that's exactly where theoretical models predict that this photo evaporation of atmospheres should start to have evolutionary consequences. And so this result should be seen as empirical evidence for the role that atmospheric metallicity might play in atmospheric escape, such that if there's higher atmospheric metallicity, maybe that's harder to photo evaporate the planet. And so this is an area where the authors suggest there could be more work done to model the role of heavy elements in cooling.
Joanna, we may have lost you for a second. I hope I see everyone else moving, but you seem to have frozen. Still there? Joanna? All right, I'm going to see if I can send her a chat. Oops, we must have lost her. She'll log back on, I'm sure, momentarily.
Yeah. Computers can glitch.
Yep.
So one of the advantages of having a meeting at the University of Maryland's observatory, you're not going to have a glitch like this with your speaker dropping out.
We still had other kinds of glitches.
Yeah, but not that many. You're a wonderful host, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Right. Elizabeth, can somebody just call her on the phone?
I don't have her number. She probably by now realizes that she got knocked off.
Okay.
Because the screen would have changed for her as well.
Right. That's one thing Zoom does pretty well. You can tell when you're not really getting through. We've had problems at Montgomery College.
I don't have her number or any way of reaching her. Maybe John does.
John, could you call her on telephone?
Oh, here she's coming back.
Okay. Ah, no, that's okay. So Elizabeth will have to co-host her so she can share her slides. It's only yep.
Well, she can share them even without being
okay.
Co-host.
Okay.
Just give her a moment.
I can't unmute. Oh, God.
You are unmuted.
I presume her microphone just didn't go out. Talking, but you can't hear me. Okay.
Joanna, you seem to be muted.
Suggestion, can you plug in another microphone? I've got a couple ways to microphone things on this computer with the four monitors, but only one of them being used to look at Zoom.
All right, so Joanna, at this point, you may just have to sort of log off, reboot your computer, and then try logging back in. I presume you can hear.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes, yay.
I'm so sorry. That's never happened to me before giving a talk. My computer just totally shut down. So let me try this again. I'm going to close, make sure everything is closed. And I'll share my screen. So sorry about that.
No worries.
I've seen that occur often with humanities faculty members at the university at Montgomery College.
Oh, odd. It must have something to do with like number of apps running or something. Okay. So now we hit play. Now you see my slide. Great. All right. Getting back to the story. So I think I had talked about this. Talked about the atmospheres. All right. So what is the punchline? Basically, the implication for this work that I think maybe I'm most excited about is that it appears that, okay, so we have the short period planets that they're so close to the star, they've lost their atmosphere. So that's, and maybe they're more massive around more metal rich stars, but okay, that's, I don't know, not that exciting to me. But at these longer periods, it seems like maybe there is a population of planets around low metallicity stars that were born rocky. And so that means that it wasn't that all small planets form that they would be sub-Neptune, gas enveloped planets,
And then some of them just lose their atmospheres. And that's why we have the super Earths and the sub Neptunes. But maybe there are some planets that really never gain any sort of hydrogen helium envelope, and that those are preferentially around lower metallicity stars. And that is just interesting to me because those are the planets that are gonna maybe be more temperate, right? They're rocky, they don't have these, the hydrogen helium envelopes aren't as large as gas giants, but it's still much more than we have on our planet. And so really I'm interested in those longer period, you know, smaller rocky planets. And it seems like from this work, at least, that the place to look for those is maybe around stars that have a lower metal content than our sun. So that's why I was excited about with this work. And maybe this suggests that that would be happening at a later stage after the gas disk dispersed, such that maybe there could be a giant impact phase similar to what we had on Earth. Zooming out even further on these systems, from other work that I have cited there in the lower left, it appears that something like one third of small planets have an outer giant planet companion. So something like, you know, the mass of Jupiter at 1 to 20 AU. And that these systems are more frequent around the more metal-rich stars. So perhaps in these systems, giant planets could have played a similar role as Jupiter in our solar system, influencing the architecture and composition of the inner planets, and maybe even helping to deliver volatiles to those inner planets. So then the question in my mind becomes, is Earth-like planet formation more common at the lower metallicities, metallicity stars, or the higher metallicity stars, right? The metallicity of a star, it's iron content, that's not an easy measurement to make, but it's sometimes easier than finding a planet. And so if we know where to look for certain types of planets, that could be really useful for doing surveys. I should say, Martin Schlecker, who I think is now a postdoc at the University of Arizona, he proposes the opposite idea than what I just talked about above. So he works on population synthesis models of planet formation, and he found through his modeling that super Earth planets that have that outer gas giant companion actually have fewer volatiles compared to those that don't have an outer giant companion. So anyway, that's a simulation. So this is something I'm really interested in exploring moving forward, kind of the role of system architecture in planet composition, and how different planets, the presence of different planets influence the compositions of the other ones in the system. All right. One more idea under this theme of how does metallicity tell us about the presence of different types of planets? This, as I talked about before, the bulk iron content of stars has been the dominant player in the star-planet connection landscape for a while. And so this is a plot from even some of the first planet detections that I talked about, right? The fraction of stars with planets, those planets that were first observed are just the giant close-in ones. And you see a very strong relationship with metallicity. Why do planets care so much about just iron? Are there other things that might be proxies or influential for the building blocks of giant planets? And what if, for example, the cores of these planets are actually more dominated by ices instead of by rocks that might have iron? And so Natalie Hinkle set out to look for evidence of other elements in addition to iron being predictors of the presence of giant planets. And she combined different groups of elements measured from both stars that do host giant planets and those that we're pretty sure don't host giant planets. You can, like I said, You never know for sure that a star has no planets, but you can say with pretty high confidence, well, we monitored this star for, you know, this long, you know, this period of time. And if there was a giant planet at a short orbital period, we would have detected that given our measurement precision. So that's a sample that it's easier to say with. Right. So she used kind of a new machine learning algorithm similar to that actually used by Netflix to recommend new films. But she used it to determine which stars were likely or unlikely to host planets. I'm not going to go into the details of the algorithm because I'm not a machine expert, but the conclusion that this methodology is correct for the time and predicting the of a close iron. That's sort of those three were really the most important, the most influential predictors of the presence of a giant planet. And so maybe that does point towards ices that we've made up of more volatile elements like carbon and oxygen being important for the formation of these giant planets. And I'll come back to this in my own work as well. Okay, so about that first question. Now, about how we still have interesting things to learn about the presence of different types of small exoplanets from investigating host star metallicity, especially in the context of system structures. And then I just showed how iron doesn't necessarily tell the whole story for the frequency or presence of giant planets. Although Natalie mentions that we do need to be cautious about sample biases in all of these types of studies. all right, so now let's look at this second category. How does stellar composition help us interpret models of planet composition? So I just showed this plot. We saw, you know, giant planets, metallicity, okay, I've drilled this in. But until recently, constraints on composition of planets have mostly been driven by data on the frequency of planets in the mass and semi-major axis plane. And so introducing more about the planet's bulk composition and even the atmospheric composition is really of interest. And so actually one can infer the bulk metallicity or heavy element enhancement of the planet by measuring only its mass and radius combining that with interior structure models. And so that's what's shown in this right plot where this is a paper from one of my colleagues, Daniel Thorngren, where and you can see the Jupiter and Saturn are the black points in this plot. And then a sample of cool giant planets, exoplanets. Those are the red points in this plot. And he basically found that as a function of the mass of the planet, as you get towards more massive planets, they have more heavy elements. He infers that they should have more heavy elements or higher mass of heavy elements. And so Daniel and his PhD advisor, Jonathan Fortney, and I were curious to know more specifically if this trend changes or strengthens with different elements from the star. So if you assume different things about that heavy element content of the planet, so broadly, do more metal-rich stars make more metal-rich planets, which you might think would be the case. That's sort of the story that we've been hearing from core accretion. But surprisingly, we found the answer was basically no. In this plot, the y-axis is what I'm saying is a residual metallicity of the planet. So it's basically using this trend from Daniel's paper, how much above or below that red fit to the data does each planet fall, right? Is it slightly more enhanced than we would predict, or slightly less enhanced based on this relation? So that's the residual metallicity. And then the x-axis in this plot is the host star composition that I measured from the stellar spectra. And in this case, Z is a bunch of elements combined together. We also did it element by element, and the trend is sort of the same. And we can exclude a linear relationship between the stellar metallicity and the planet, you know, enhanced residual metallicity at a two sigma level. And yet this type of relationship is exactly what's predicted by formation models. If there's twice as much metal in the feeding zone of a giant planet, you would expect twice as much metals to go on the planet. So it's really, this was a quite surprising result and probably points towards more complex disk processes like the drift of grains through the disk that affect the relationship of material by changing the solid surface density of the disk. And so it really depends exactly where in the disk your planet is forming. There could be like pockets of enhanced metal enhancement in regions of the disk. But we don't actually know the cause of this kind of mismatch between our expectations and our observations. It's an open question still, I would say, in planet formation theory. But coming back to these volatiles, right? Like we saw in Natalie's work, carbon and oxygen seem to be important. In this paper, we saw that there is a weak, but it's there, correlation between that same residual metallicity in the planets and the ratio of the volatiles to refractory elements in the star. So in this case, the volatiles are carbon and oxygen, and the refractories are all the other elements that I measured. And because volatiles are relatively abundant and can be found in both gas and solid phases in the disk, we sort of hypothesized from the start that they might be affecting planet metallicity differently. And so maybe we're seeing evidence of this. And maybe this, like I said, matches with Natalie's findings about what stellar abundances predict giant planet occurrence. And so something that I'm really excited about moving forward is following up these cool giant planets where we have the host star measurement. We have a constraint on the metallicity, the bulk metallicity of the planet from its mass and radius. But what would be great is knowing how those metals in the planet are distributed exactly. So really measuring the metal content in the planet's atmospheres, because that's going to be a fingerprint of better indicator, at least, of where in the disk they form, because that's what accreted last on the planet. It's what's in its atmosphere. And so this will be something to test with the recently launched JWST. Okay, so I've talked about big planets. Transitioning back to small planets now, we'd really like to understand their interior composition as well. But we run into an issue in distinguishing different components of their composition. So the mantle of a planet versus its core versus an envelope of some sort of volatiles, which could be even water. And this is hard to do using exoplanet mass and radius measurements alone. So these are ternary diagrams from Deanna Valencia's 2017 paper. So if you had the composition of a planet, it would be a single point on this plot. But instead, for a given mass and radius, there's a band representing a range of compositions for this planet that are degenerate. So let me go back a second. So for example, like I just pointed, a 10 Earth mass planet with a radius of about 2 Earth radii could have a composition that is consistent with 70% mantle. So that's the top of this ternary diagram. You see mantle, water, and core at the corners of the triangle. So this purple point has a 70% mantle composition, 15% core, and 15% water. But that same planet, the same mass and the same radius, is also consistent with a composition that is 15% mantle and 45% core and 45% water. And there's a similar issue when including hydrogen and helium envelopes. So how do we tell the differences between these mixtures? That's where the host star composition comes in. So these host star abundances have been shown to help break the degeneracies that I just talked about. So this is a paper from Caroline Dorn, where she used an interior model of the Earth without prior knowledge or placing any prior constraints on the refractory bulk composition. And so that's the top line of plots. And you can see that it's a poor match between the blue and the green. The green is like the known, because we know what it is for the Earth, right? We're testing this on the Earth. But when she includes a prior knowledge of those refractory element abundances based on the sun, she does a much better job at retrieving the actual values. So the blue histograms, which is like the result, better matches the green independently known values, the correct ones we know from the Earth. And so in response to this, a few studies, more than these, have suggested that a way to break this degeneracy is to use the host star iron and magnesium and silicon compositions to constrain that refractory rocky composition of planets. However, I'll show you in the next study that this assumption should be called into question. So this is a new study by Deanna Valencia and her graduate student, Michael Plotnikov. And so in this study, they restrict themselves only to planets that they think are mostly rocky. So not having a large hydrogen helium envelope, and that these planets have mass and radius measurements. And so they can compare the refractory ratios of rocky planets. So they, in the case that I'll talk about, these planets, because they don't have this extra water or hydrogen helium envelope, they don't suffer as much of that degeneracy in the composition. Like you're basically only looking at things with a mantle and a core. So they take those types of planets, constrain the refractory ratios in the planets just using planet information, which they can do pretty confidently. And then they compare those to the stars and look for differences. And so by comparing the results of their rocky planet modeling to actually a population of stellar abundances from planet hosting stars. So in this case, it's not a one-to-one comparison planet to star, but it's these planets and then all planet hosting stars, basically. They find that even with large error bars, that the planets span a wider range. So the planets are the purple and green points, but they span a wider range than that red ellipse, which is the stars. And this is shown again, kind of in a different way in this plot, which is now showing planet mass and radius with their planets plotted. And the region that's occupied by the composition of stars is in red. And so that would denote like a primordial composition. And it's much narrower than the full span of the planet compositions that they infer. And so it's clear that many planets sit outside of that stellar range, but the error bars are still a little bit too large at this point to make definite conclusions. However, I think a study like this calls into question the assumption of just using, assuming that like star equals planet for these refractory ratios in small planets. Finally, this last example of this that I wanted to share is one that I just think is so cool, that we can use stellar abundances both to infer the past presence of planets and the compositions of those planets. So our current knowledge of the bulk composition of planets, including our Earth, is somewhat limited. In the left there, I'm showing a plot from the sun's abundances versus those in CI chondrites, which is you know, a primitive type of material in the solar system. And for the most part, those track pretty well to the accuracy to which, you know, solar photospheric abundances can be measured. The sun, the Earth, and these chondrites are a very good match, at least for non-volatile elements. And the differences in the volatile elements are explained by different processes in the disk of condensation. So this really suggests that the formation location of planetary bodies can be probed by measuring the depletion in these species with respect to the host star abundances. So this is another vote in the star planet connection bin. And actually, the most direct way to observe the composition of exoplanetary material, right? I'm talking about like inferring things by comparing mass and radius models. Like you have to include an interior model in there, but we can measure the chemical abundances of rocky bodies that have accreted onto white dwarfs and polluted their atmospheres. So at, you know, the end stages of stellar lives, like that of our sun, it should turn into a white dwarf. And strong metal absorption lines have been detected in many white dwarf spectra. Now, metals in the atmospheres of these stars should and become, you know, unobservable on the timescales of hundreds to millions of years, or even less. The fact that we're observing metals in their atmospheres, that must mean that process is happening, the accreted material that happened recently and is probably being replenished. We think many stars host planets, and when the star leaves the main sequence, it expands, becomes a red giant, and eventually, you know, becomes a white dwarf. And during that process, the radius expands greatly, right? And engulfs and vaporizes any inner planets, and outer planets might survive, but probably are destabilized and scattered. And then planetesimal material that is left during the white dwarf stage can lead to planetary bodies being perturbed and thrown into the white dwarf star, becoming entirely disrupted and accreting to form a disk. And these disks around white dwarf stars have also been observed. The prevailing explanation is that many white dwarfs are accreting exoplanet leftover material. And what is interesting is you can measure, like I said, the composition of that material, and to zero with order their elemental compositions are not so different than the Earth. And so in this paper, this is a figure from a paper from a few years ago, but you can see kind of a cartoon breakdown of the composition of bulk Earth versus something like Comet Halley, which has a much higher fraction of carbon, for example. But in the plot, then, I'm showing just different representations of different white dwarfs where their abundance patterns have been measured, these polluted white dwarfs. They really do not appear to be carbon rich. They're much more similar to an Earth-like composition. So they're dominated by oxygen and iron and silicon and magnesium. And carbon is always depleted relative to the solar abundance. And usually water is not very common either. This was also shown in a more recent study by Ali Doyle from a few years ago. And so in this plot, she's now comparing, I sort of shaded out some of the not bulk Earth things, but you can see, you know, also comparing the white dwarfs, which are there, Pluto white dwarfs, which are there on the right, to the bulk Earth, which I've highlighted, but you can sort of see other bodies as well. You know, they're moderately similar. There's not drastic differences. And what was also really cool about this paper is that they went a step further. So this was a kind of interdisciplinary paper where it was astronomers, but also geochemists. And they were interested in comparing the oxygen fugacity of rock, which is a measure of how oxidizing or reducing its surroundings were when the rock formed. And minerals at different oxygen fugacities have different physical properties. And so this oxygen fugacity will influence the interior structure of an exoplanet and maybe how it evolved over time. And so in this paper, they measured or they constrained this oxygen fugacity in this polluted white dwarf material. And out of these six systems, they found they all had similar oxygen fugacities to these bodies in the solar system, which are in that blue band. It's seeming like a lot of, you know, the most direct measurements we have of extrasolar body interior composition, at least the leftovers, it does appear to be consistent with solar system compositions and the small samples we have so far. All right, so in this block, I started talking about how in my own work, even though we thought metal-rich stars, you know, would make metal-rich planets, observational evidence doesn't quite support that. And so we definitely need to address that with more modeling efforts. And then I just talked about how we might call into question this relationship between the host star refractory abundances and small planet refractories. Those might not be interchangeable, but we definitely need more studies to quantify that, and also better masses of the planets. It really, how similar the star and planet compositions are is going to depend to some extent how well we can constrain those planet compositions, which depend on their masses. And then I just talked about these really interesting polluted white dwarf systems and how they seem to be consistent with Earth-like, broadly Earth-like compositions. So I'll just conclude by saying a few speculations about what I think we'll be talking about, you know, the next time I would give this talk in a few years. So a lot of these host star composition studies have been limited to, as you saw, like tens, at most hundreds of stars, but with the large spectroscopic surveys that are coming online, like Apogee, which is part of Sloan 4, SDSS 4, and SDSS 5. These are all sky spectroscopic surveys. I think we're gonna be in a totally different regime of mapping stellar composition across the entire sky, which is very complementary to the all sky capabilities of exoplanet finding surveys, like a mission which kind of came, was the little sibling, I guess, to the Kepler mission, which is called TESS, or the Terrestrial Exoplanet Survey Satellite, which is another transiting exoplanet survey satellite. So another transiting exoplanet mission, but Kepler just stared at one patch of the sky, whereas TESS is looking all across the sky. And so I listed a couple references there. Of course, something many people, including me, have been working on for years is the comparison of exoplanet atmospheric ratios, particularly the carbon to oxygen ratio to that of its host star. And this comparison might tell us something about, in particular for giant planets, where the planet formed. For example, if the carbon to oxygen ratio in the atmosphere of the giant planet is higher than that of the host star, so it has more carbon than oxygen versus the star, might be evidence that the planet formed beyond the water snow line, and so had accreted a lot of, was not able to accrete a lot of oxygen into its atmosphere because it was trapped in icy planetesimals. And so these studies have sort of started to begin on an individual planet by planet basis, but again, this is going to be totally broken open by JDUST, measuring a lot of planet atmosphere compositions. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the growing synergistic opportunities between my geoscience colleagues to use host star abundances as a motivation for more extensive wider ranging parameters of high pressure, high temperature experiments to see how different materials at different magnesium to silicon or magnesium to iron ratios, how those materials behave at the temperatures and pressures of small planets, which we need that information to help calculate or at least estimate those interior models of planets. Right now, a lot of it is just extrapolation from data that's based on the Earth. And so as the astronomical data grows in number and precision, it will be increasingly important to ground our observations in this type of experimental work. And I'm sure there's lots more. I know there's lots more of excellent work I didn't have time to talk about here, but I wanted to end, maybe you've seen this video already, but I'll talk and then I'll play it so you can hear it. Hopefully you'll be able to hear it. I just wanted to leave you with this impression of the thousands of planets around other stars that have been discovered throughout the galaxy. So in this movie, there'll be planet detections that start popping up that are color-coded by their detection method and sound-coded by the planet orbital frequency. Let me play this. Hopefully you'll be able to hear the sound. Let me turn my sound up. Conclude and take questions and apologize for the technical difficulties.
That was awesome. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, so let's get some questions. Go ahead and raise your hand and I'll call on you. Go ahead, Sue.
Yes, maybe I'm missing something, but it seemed like you would have to control for the mass of the star as well as the metallicity, because you can have stars of the same mass with different metallicity, but if you're just looking at different metallicity stars, they might have very different masses.
Yeah. So actually I didn't show it in my, where is my mouse? I didn't show it in my, here we go, in my talk, but there's a nice review paper that came out a few years ago that did exactly this. It said the important or two important dimensions are the metallicity and the mass. And you should think of it really on those two axes. My talk was just about stellar composition, so that's what I focused on. But of course, the stellar mass We think like more massive stars have more massive disks. And so if you're, like you said, if you have a disk around an M dwarf star and a disk around a solar type star, those might not be, that's not an apples to apples comparison, even if they have the same metallicity. So that's a really important point. And it seems like, again, fitting into this picture of kind of core accretion, that giant planets really do seem to be more rare around lower mass stars, and that small planets seem to be very common around small stars. So great point.
Jay?
Yeah, in talking about where planets are, they've talked about the fact that planets like Jupiter might have formed closer in and then moved out. And this could have caused the planets other planets to sort of move around also. How does that affect your results?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, this is why trying to get measurements of the planet's atmospheres, I think, could be really key, because that, to some extent, is like I said, going to be a last imprint of the thing that last happened, right? The last part of the planet's formation, if there was some sort of, if it accreted solids right at the end of its formation, if it started forming inside the disk, but then accreted its gas envelope farther out or vice versa. If we can measure that atmospheric composition, that will at least start to give us clues as to when and where the atmosphere was accreted, which is the last place the planet was. But that's, yeah, it's so complicated. I didn't mention this either, but I'm leading a survey to measure the masses of some of these small transiting planets. But a really key part of that survey is not just measuring the small planet and their transiting planet, so then we can have the mass and the radius and get a bulk density, but we are also continuing to monitor those systems with radial velocities to look for outer giant planet companions, because I really think system architecture, it's a very hard parameter to constrain, because planets, you know, they don't have to be transiting, right? They can be in any orientation and they're hard to detect, or very long period and they're hard to detect. But I think, I mean, clearly it was so important in our solar system. I think it must be important in other planetary systems too. So yeah, we have to keep an eye on that as best we can.
All right, any other questions?
I saw in the chat, the huge patch in the video at the end was Kepler, yes. So they had like two or three big planet releases. And as I mentioned, Kepler found thousands of transiting planets, but it was just staring at that one patch of the sky. I don't know if you noticed in the video, kind of towards the end, there were other little patches that sort of traced out a line in the sky. And that was actually the successor. Those are from the successor to Kepler, which is called the K2 mission. And that was observing along the ecliptic in the galaxy. Hi, Guy.
Hey, Johanna. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. That video, it seemed like the count of the various different methods of detection seemed to be really, really far off, because they'd discovered lots of them, and there's only like maybe 100, maybe.
Oh, so there was, it was in the upper right and in the upper left. There were, I wasn't paying attention, so I didn't know if both of them were going.
Okay. All right, so maybe I just missed that. Okay.
Most of them were in the, I think the upper left corner had transits and radial velocities, and that's the majority of them, I think.
Oh, okay. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't see that.
Okay. So the video is made in collaboration between NASA and a group called System Sounds. And so you should absolutely go to their webpage. They have awesome videos about TRAPPIST-1 as well. Maybe you're familiar with.
Heard of it.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got a question. QR.
Yeah. Thanks for your presentation. I'm confused about degeneracy of planets. Can you comment upon the degeneracy of the of the planets in our solar system? And what is your guess as to why there are so many rocky planets in our solar system? Or do we have a lot of rocky planets?
Yeah, so when I was saying degeneracies, I was talking about the planet composition. And in some cases, even when you know the mass and the radius, it's just that that mass and radius of a planet. That can be matched by multiple different combinations of like iron core, a rocky mantle, and some sort of volatile envelope in different percentages. And so that's what I meant by degeneracies. In terms of rock planets, it seems like most, well, the number is I wouldn't say like super pinned down, but it does seem like most stars host some kind of planet, and that maybe something like 20-30% of sun-like stars host a small rocky or maybe sub-Neptune sized planet. So rocky, but with some sort of volatile envelope. And so in that sense, I would say our solar system is not super different, but all these planets that we've detected are super close orbital periods, right? They're very short orbital periods. You know, some of them are many of them are at 10 or 20 days. So it's that we don't have one of those nothing like that in our solar system. That is what is puzzling to me. And what is, you know, one of the questions that keeps me up at night is our solar system unique or not? Like, is it strange or not? And I think we don't know quite yet. I would say one hint in the yes column is that we don't have one of, you know, these close in small planets, but we haven't done a good enough survey of the outer parts of exoplanet systems, you know, where Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus are in our solar system, to know if those types of planets are common or not. Upcoming missions will help us understand that better, though.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Is there a question from Jeffrey?
Yes. Has your research detected other Earth-like planets with Earth-like atmospheres around stars at distances where life would be possible?
The answer is no. There have been, I would say, some planets detected around their stars that seem to have either a mass or radius. Occasionally, we have measurements of both of those that are, you know, Earth-like, so that the mass is roughly, you know, Earth mass, maybe a little bit bigger, and the radius is roughly Earth radius, maybe a little bigger. There's a handful of those. And then the handful gets even smaller when you put a temperature constraint on that, where you could have liquid water on the surface. But in that bin, most of those planets are around stars that are much less massive than the sun. So they're M-dwarf stars. And maybe that's okay. But we know that these lower mass stars are more active when they're younger. And we don't know if that's so good for habitability and for life. If you have a lot more energy impinging on your atmosphere, can you keep the atmosphere at those early times? And so I'm optimistic. I should say, in terms of atmosphere detection, we basically have no atmosphere detections of these, you know, planets in these bins that I'm talking about. The first of these will come with JWST. So there's several programs that are going to survey the TRAPPIST-1 system, which is this system around, it's so fascinating. It's a seven planet system of all like rocky, you know, roughly Earth size, Earth mass planets orbiting a star that is roughly the size of Jupiter. So a very low mass star. And J2ST is going to survey those planets' atmospheres and tell us what they're made of. But there just aren't that many that we can do that for even at this point. And certainly no, I mean, another area that I'm interested in for my research is developing instruments that will allow us to actually detect Earth analogs. So planets that are orbiting solar-like stars in Earth-like orbits, right? So like 365 day, you know, longer orbits, and yet are still Earth mass, Earth size. Right now, we can't really detect even those types of planets.
Thank you.
Yes, so TBD is the short answer. Other questions? QR, did you still have a question or is that a residual hand?
I have one more question. Sure. Yeah. This is maybe a little bit off, but do you have any guesses as to what happened to the atmosphere of Mars?
I don't. That's not an area of expertise for me. So I don't have guesses. I will say, which is also slightly tangential, but is related maybe. So we think of Mars and Venus and Earth, like those are, Mercury is also a rocky planet in our solar system, but it's a little bit of an oddball because it's so, so dense. And so like Venus and Earth and Mars, like maybe those are sort of sibling planets. And I'm part of a JWST program that will be observing the atmospheres of other sibling planets in other systems. And so that will give us, and these are small planets, so between 1 and 3 Earth radii. So that will at least give us some context as to what, like whether in other systems, sibling planets have similar atmospheres or not. So maybe that will be illuminating. Yeah.
I actually have a partial answer to that.
Okay.
Peter Driscoll from Carnegie gave our previous talk, and he's an expert on that particular thing about whether a magnetic field that protects you from your stellar wind is essential. And it's thought that Mars being smaller, its core cooled sooner. And once once you lose that fluid dynamic dynamo mechanism, you lose your magnetic field.
So it couldn't hold on to its atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe there's some sweet spot where you're just big enough or just small enough to be on that threshold.
No.
Other questions?
If not, then Jeff, were you about to ask?
Yeah, just one other thing. Isn't there an Earth-like planet that's going around Alpha Centauri, which is, I guess, the closest star system to us.
Mm-hmm.
And do we know whether or not its atmosphere is also similar, or any of the work that you're doing can make any statements about it?
Yeah, so that planet, I think, I don't know the latest. It was detected, and then that there was some evidence presented, like maybe it's not actually a planet, maybe it's actually a stellar activity signal. So I don't remember what the latest is. But in any case, it was detected via this radial velocity method. And so it doesn't actually transit its host star. And so that means that detecting its atmosphere, right? Usually we do that when the planet passes in front of the star, and the light filters through the planet's atmosphere, you know, in our line of sight. And so if the planet doesn't transit, we have other ways to maybe measure the atmosphere, but usually the planet has to be pretty close to the star. And in this case, it's in a more Earth-like orbit, so it's not very close to the star. So I don't know that we'll ever have good constraints on the atmosphere of that planet if it exists, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you.
Even though it's the closest one, it seems counterintuitive.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Guy.
Just a comment. When you think about the number of times that life has been almost completely wiped out on our planet and how important water and carbon are to life on this planet and how actually such a small fraction of Earth's mass is water.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you think about, you know, all these other places, they're all various versions of hell compared to us. We are incredibly lucky to even be here. And, you know, there's no place like it that we've discovered.
Mm-hmm.
If we mess this up, there is no planet B.
That is 100% correct. That was actually, I had that on a slide at the end, but I was running out of time, so I wanted to conclude quickly. But that is a point that I try to make in most talks. We have this, like you said, super wide diversity of exoplanets, but really in that menagerie, there we haven't found anything that could be Earth 2.0. We're still looking, but we're never going to be able to go there. It's so precious what we have.
Better not.
Yeah, I actually have some colleagues at Carnegie astronomers who are farther along in their careers than me, and are actually kind of looking towards how they could use their skills kind of in computational modeling to work on climate change issues. So it's something that we're thinking about at Carnegie as well. We have a whole department of global ecology, so.
The other thing is how far these planets that we've found, how far out? I mean, we're only going a couple of hundred light years away from the Earth, aren't we?
Yeah.
So we're looking at a very small area of the galaxy.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes a little bit farther than that, the Kepler planets especially tend to be maybe even thousands of light years away. But yes, compared to the entire Milky Way, only a small chunk. We think, you know, statistics wise that like physics operates similarly everywhere. So if we're finding planets around nearby stars, they probably should exist around farther away stars. But I mean, talking about metallicity, right? Like something I'm really interested in actually is, you know, there are populations of stars in our galaxy that have very, very different metallicities than our local neighborhood. They're much, much lower metallicities. And in fact, it's thought that some of these very low metallicity stars maybe didn't even form in our galaxy. They might have formed in like a neighbor dwarf galaxy and been accreted into the Milky Way. And there's evidence of streams of stars that suggest that this has happened. And so like how low can you go with metallicity and planet formation? That has been predicted theoretically, but not well tested observationally. And so this is I'm working on this with different groups of people to around stars where we know the metallicity is lower than what theory predicts you should have planets. We're looking for planets there. Like, let's try to prove theory wrong.
If there are no further questions, let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.
It was a really good talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, hopefully at some point I'll get to meet everyone who I haven't already met in person. I'd love to attend an in-person meeting sometime.
Yeah.
We would love to have you too.
Yeah.
To come to, and as an aside, when we were talking about the Unistellar telescope, David Dunham said a Unistellar telescope could be used quite easily to do his favorite topic, which is occultation, asteroid occultations. So for those people that are thinking of buying telescopes, Unistellar is a way to go for doing all kinds of different things.
So, they're so expensive.
Well, yeah, but when you get older, you have more disposable money.
You're yeah.
Your salary keeps going up. If you get old, if you're 71 like me,
you're a youngster.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
You know, I'm drawing Social Security. My Social Security can pay for that I don't even need, could pay for one easily. See?
They're very impressive.
They're very impressive, and they can do a number of interesting things, and as well as lots of outreach. And I might mention planetariums like the Digistar are really good for producing videos and imaging lots of catalog stuff. I mean, you might even want to use a planetarium just for its video capacity.
But there's nothing quite like looking through a telescope.
Oh, sure, sure. That's why you want a telescope.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why, you know, I took delivery. I've got a dangerous telescope in back of me. It converted a kid into a real physicist. Now, he has not been an astronomer after he's a material scientist now, but it doesn't really matter. But even if he spent a time at Lowell Observatory, you know, and this whole evolution, I got it from his father, and his father said, give it to a place where it'll be used. So I'll use it, but it's a Nexstar 130T. And so we have all these, and if you're somebody like me, you accumulate, people give you these things, although you then have to use them in some way in the bigger community. So.
All right, well, thanks again.
I'd like to draw everyone's attention to the message by Elizabeth near the end of the chat. That's a very worthwhile thing.
And I'd like to recommend a book. I like audio books. I listen to them when I'm driving. But the book that I'm listening to now is called The Last Stargazer by Emily Levesque.
She's amazing. I saw her give a talk recently.
And it's interesting. I mean, she talks about how she, and she's young, but it talks about how she got into astronomy. And then it covers what it's like to be a professional astronomer and all the problems and et cetera. I find it a fascinating book. And I would certainly recommend that if you know of somebody who's young and maybe interested in getting into astronomy, I think it would be a fantastic book for them to read.
Okay. I guess we can start signing off.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone,
for attending.
We'll see you next month.
Okay. Yes.
That was a great talk, and thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
See you, folks.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.